your business is not a personal slush fund. So let's make sure you keep that clean.
It's not a slush fund. It's a travel fund. It's a travel fund.
Oops.
Oh, damn it. Speaking of which, I just started booking all kinds
of travel. So much for franchising for Chris.
Oh, yeah. Boy. It's a travel fund, not a slush fund.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Small Business Safari, where I help guide you to avoid those traps, pitfalls, and dangers that lurk when navigating the wild world of small business ownership. I'll share those gold nuggets of information and invite guests to help accelerate your ascent to that mountaintop of success. It's a jungle out there, and I want to help you traverse through the levels of owning your own business that can get you bogged down and distract you from hitting your own personal and professional goals. So strap in, adventure team, and let's take a ride through the safari and get you to the mountaintop.
Oh, we just started.
Yes, everybody, we just started. Alan said, hey, let's go ahead and hit the hot mic. And I said, did it already. So here we go. We're already doing it.
No. we were just talking about why you can't lose your COVID weight.
Yeah, what, that's not for the podcast.
I believe it is.
I have an eating and drinking problem.
People have a vested interest. They want to know that you're going to be around.
Yeah. Well, I'm back in the gym. So I got that going for me. So
do they let you bring beer into the gym?
No, but I come in with my little beer hat on. They told me that I have to put it to the side before I go start working out. All right, everybody, here we go. Small Business Safari episode. Looking forward to this one. We have a great guest today, and we got him in studio. And we're excited because when we get him in studio, we get to all say cheers.
Cheers. He caught me with my mouth full.
Yes. So cheers.
Cheers.
We have Tom DeFore of Big Sky Franchising here today.
Extra cheers because you actually finally bought some beer.
I did. So finally, did I not ask Alan to not only give up his time for free and then come here for free, but I also make him bring the beer, which costs him money just to be an opportunity to hang with me.
I'm way upside down, Tom. This is not a good viable franchise model.
This is not a good viable franchise model. And this episode, we're definitely going to be talking a lot about franchising and everything else that goes on with it. But really, you know, it's going to be all those facets about how to run a good business, because I know Tom's actually bought into a franchise, ran a good business, and actually empowered his team to go out and buy it from him. So it's even better. So
exit strategy.
Oh my gosh, does he have one? He did. I don't. We got to work on that. So I keep alluding to him, but I'm not going to introduce him. I'm going to have him introduce himself. So Tom, who are you and where the hell are you from?
Sure. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Tom DeFore. I'm the founder and CEO of Big Sky Franchise Team. That's my main business that I run. And we're based locally here. You know, obviously we met years ago, Chris, and have been crossing paths for quite some time here. And we're based in Alpharetta, Georgia, here in the Atlanta area. And originally from the, grew up in the Chicago area. So Northerner transplant down to the South, but this is home now.
So you have the Big Sky Franchising Team, but your history, your kind of the way you got into this world was you were in the franchise broker world before. And I remember I told this, I said, Alan, I wasn't going to bring this up, but I do remember the story when we first met is that there's two big franchise companies headquartered in Chicago and you were with the good one, not the bad one. So talk to us about how you came out of school and you said, man, franchising's for me. I'm going to go do this. And that's where you went. Or did it just kind of happen?
Yeah. So my I was a business management major in college, and I knew I wanted to work at a management consulting company. I didn't know in doing what, but I don't have no idea why. I just that seemed to be the way I wanted to go. And so I graduated early. I always think that's fun, and made it through. And just by I really call it kind of chance, happened to have an opportunity working at a company that specialized in helping other businesses turn into a franchise. That was just the management consulting company that I ended up in. And I fell in love with the business. I loved entrepreneurship and always knew from early on. I remember even back in high school thinking being here in the United States, we have such a great opportunity to start a business, to be an entrepreneur. I almost feel like it's a duty. If you're an American, you have a duty to at least try once, you know, start your own business at least once.
That's right. Be American, start your own business, go out there and fail. Thrive, everybody, thrive.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And look, you got to give it a fair shake. We have a great opportunity here that most people around the world don't have that kind of an opportunity. You get an idea, you can start a business today or tomorrow and make it go. And so I always love that. And my dad started I saw him working. He was in the car business for his whole career. He started when he was 16 and decided when I was maybe in junior high, he opened up a little used car lot. Saw him kind of live out his dream and just ran this little car lot for decades. And it's great. It helped put me through college. And so I thought, wow, this franchise thing, this franchise company I'm working at really couples together this idea of entrepreneurship, which I love, helping other budding entrepreneurs, and I'm helping coach, advise, and be a consultant along the way. So fell in love with that and have, for the most part, stayed in the industry, in the franchise community for, it'll be 19 years in December. So
you mentioned that you graduated early. So you graduated from college when you were what, 16, 17?
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously, and of course, if you can't see him on here, but you can see him on Facebook Live, if you ever go out there and check it out, he is a young looking man.
Yet again, another in the endless string of guests with more hair, better looking than us, Chris.
Once again,
we set a low bar, but I mean, come on.
We do set a low bar here, but we definitely have always outkicked our coverage by having people like Tom show up.
We need to get some ugly people on the show
so we can feel better about ourselves. Yeah. It's always better feeling better about yourself and you can put other people down.
Where'd you go to school, though?
I went to just a small private school. It's called Elmhurst College. Well, Elmhurst University. They changed their name now, but Elmhurst University, just outside of Chicago. And then I went to DePaul for my MBA.
Yeah. Well, how'd you end up in Atlanta?
Had a business opportunity down here, came down and then just decided this was home after we were here for a little while. Found it. And my wife reminds me regularly that she said, I'm free to go anywhere I'd like, but she's not leaving. And so
sounds familiar.
Atlanta's home. Yeah. And we love it here.
So you get into the franchising world. What was the first franchise system or company that you actually helped get into business? And are they still going?
Oh, goodness. That is a great question. The very first one, I don't recall the very first one, but I can tell you an early on one that I remember. One of my a little success story was a Canadian franchise called Mobiline out of British Columbia. Actually, on Vancouver Island in British Columbia. Like you got to take a ferry to get to and from, you know.
Talk about being niche.
Yes, very niche. And they're in the service business. And what they do is they do mobile wheel alignment and kingpin refurbishing for semi-trucks or for tractors. And that's their whole little niche and business model. They have it down to this specific science. They can come on site and do the work. And I always remember because I was like, wow, this is really unique. It's kind of like what you're saying. It's super niche. And they've franchised a bunch of locations across Canada and now starting to expand in the U.S. They have one franchisee, actually, ironically, just down the road from the studio here in the Atlanta area.
All right. How about that?
That's amazing.
It is amazing that it went from Vancouver Island all the way here to Atlanta, followed Tom. All the way.
Fabulous studios.
Yeah. That's right. Well, Burbank Studios. And you got here the Trusted Toolbox Studio, which is sponsoring this podcast of the Small Business Safari.
You're such a giver.
Right. All right.
Oh, well, I've got a question for you. And I saw on your website, you know, you had like three things that, you know, maybe you could think about that would tell you that you could become a franchise or turn your business into a franchise. Boy, did I bungle that. But anyway, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
What are some things that you're seeing out there? Oh man, I got a million questions for you. But when you talk to somebody and you've turned somebody down,
mm-hmm.
Why would you have turned somebody down?
Yeah. Great, great question. So
it really was a great question, just so poorly delivered.
I'm gonna echo that. Great question. Just we have no idea what you really asked. Okay, let's let him answer.
Finish
it.
This beer, and I'll ask it again.
So, to your point, in those three big ideas we look for when we look at a business to turn into a franchise. So, first and foremost, what we like to look for is an operating prototype. One, but really a profitable prototype, right? If you're going to be franchising, I mean, it seems to be a given, but if you're going to be franchising, you'd like to have a model that you can showcase. You need this show unit for someone to come and check it out. And in today's world in franchising, there are a lot more what we're calling virtual discovery days or meet and greets where they come in and meet one another. But still, even if you're walking around on a Zoom call or a FaceTime or whatever it might be, you still want to be able to show them an active operating unit and have confidence in it. The second part then is looking for a business model that has a customer base on preferably a national basis so that you have customers on a broad enough segment so that you can have enough locations that it makes sense to do it. At minimum, regional. So if you're in the Southeast, that if it's a regional thing, well, you want to have enough room to grow. If you're going to franchise, you want to be able to have enough locations that's worth your while or enough franchises. And then the third thing is the ability to train someone or to transfer that knowledge. So can you teach someone how to run your business model? And if, for by way of example, if with the Trusted Toolbox, if you were to look at franchising the Trusted Toolbox, well, would someone have to be maybe a handyman to do it? Or would they just need to be able to manage a business and hire people to do it? So if there's a specific skill set, then we make that a requirement as a mandatory. And I use this example often, but we have a great example is we have this client we worked with a year or two ago, and it's been now, that's a dental practice. It's a mobile veterinarian office, I should say.
So mobile veterinarian, like just for, but for teeth or mobile veterinarian?
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Like we're working on doggy teeth, cat teeth, gorilla teeth, dolphin teeth. I'm just trying. All right. Okay. I got it back.
You asked it much better, but it was a terrible question.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah. Mobile veterinarian clinic, right? So to own that in most states, you have to be a veterinarian. So the franchisor is not teaching people how to become a veterinarian. Right. There are schools and programs, how you go through and become that. And then you're selling the franchise, the business model, the name, the brand, the system, the processes to that.
So I've always heard that you had to have at least, say, 5 locations or something to show that you can scale it and it's repeatable. Is that kind of a litmus test for you?
Great question. And to me, that is one of the I think that's franchise folklore. And I say that while that's a nice to have, that'd be great to have that. The reality is most budding franchisors, that entrepreneur that has a successful something, one of the reasons they're looking into franchising is because they don't want more company-owned units. They don't want to run it. They either don't have the money, number one, or they don't want to invest it. They've already taken enough risk. They've done the risk to build their initial operating unit, and they're finally maybe paid off the debt or recouped an investment that they've been waiting for. Or the second piece is maybe they're just tired of managing people. They're tired of hiring, training.
Whoever gets tired of that.
Should we just stop this podcast so you can sign up now?
Right. Oh, wow. But no, I love people. I hurt people. I do, but okay. So back to that. So they don't train them how to be a veterinarian. They train them on how to be a mobile veterinarian.
Yeah. They teach them how to run the business model itself. That's right. How do you run this business model? How do you market? How do you attract customers, retain customers, those kinds of aspects of the business model? That's the general idea. So if you think about, okay, from now, there are more layers underneath each of those three. But if you think about, okay, how do I know if my business is viable or worthwhile to be considered to be franchised? Number one is a profitable prototype. Number two is that there's enough opportunity or customer base for it. And then number three is that you can train someone how to do it. And that oftentimes comes down to what I view as more the heart of the owner. Do you have a teacher's heart? And some people view it as teaching, coaching, training, consulting. All of those are the same vein. Some people say, well, I want to be a consultant or I want to be a coach. Well, you can do that if you franchise your own business because now you're coaching, you're consulting. Or if you have a teacher's heart, I just want to teach. I love training. Great. Franchising fits for that. It'd be franchising your business. So if you have that kind of a mindset or a drive or an interest, franchising can be a great fit to meet that need and capitalize on an asset that you've already built. That's what I love about franchising is you're capitalizing on an asset you have. How can we, you're capturing or bottling that intellectual property that you've already created and figuring out how to now sell that or transfer it to someone else to use.
You've got a ton of questions. So should I let you keep going? I'm going to.
Yeah, no, I got a ton of questions. Originally, when we were first talking to Tom, we were just saying, okay, you're going to introduce yourself and maybe you should just ask your own questions. But I think we should ask a few questions, don't you?
Let's hit him.
Yeah. So one of the things I find interesting about franchising is, and first of all, I'm coming from a perspective of, I love franchising.
Okay.
I think it's just, it's a... less risk. And I know, you know, I've had my own business before. And when you sit there and go, okay, we need to have this process, and then you have to create it, or this type of vendor, and you have to go search for it and vet it. And in franchising, it just takes all of that, you know, off your table, off your plate. And, you know, there's somebody who's already been vetted. Here's a process that already works. And it just saves you an enormous amount of time and an enormous amount of money. So there's a million reasons why I love franchising. One of the things that drives me crazy about franchising is just, it seems like franchising sometimes kills the goose that lays the golden egg. As an example, I moved here 25 years ago to Atlanta, and I don't even know if there was a good burger joint in Atlanta at the time, or if there was maybe Ray's. Did you ever go to Ray's?
Ray's on the River?
No.
I know.
It's R-H-E-A. And it's up with a couple of...
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
I know the one. Anyway. I love... They have a great burger, by the way. I love that
and
place.
And that was the only burger I could actually think of. I came from out west where there were a lot of burger places, and they're all independent. Well, then all of a sudden, boom, I don't know who was the first one, you know, the Smash Burger, and then BurgerFi. And now there's a million of them. They're all franchised. They all claim to be unique, and yet they're all kind of the same, because you go up there and you get your burger, and then it's sort of the Subway model, except for with burgers. And then there'll be this whole wave, and they're just kind of killing their own market. And then it was pizzas, and then it was cupcakes, and then it was. And so the thing that drives me crazy about franchising is, as soon as somebody has a good concept, it seems like everybody else is scrambling to duplicate it. And I guess it's more of a statement than a question, but I was just kind of curious to your thought, especially when you're somebody who is actually helping people take their business to the franchise world. Are you looking for something more unique, or are you, I'll just stop with that. How's that?
Yeah, yeah. Great. Yeah, no, I appreciate that question. Very fair. And in with common franchise industries, you mentioned several of them, with hamburgers, with pizza, hotels. It's like, how many times can you reinvent the same thing over and over, right? It's the same concept.
Right.
It's burgers, it's fries and a shake and a Coke. It's those same things reiterated in different ways, with different quality, with different service, different experience, over and over and over again. Early on in my career, I used to think that there's no way this can ever keep working. And at this stage of my career, I've recognized that Americans love pizza and they love hamburgers, and these concepts continue to work. And is as long as the number of meals Americans continue to consume outside of the home continue to go up, which generally speaking does every year and has for decades, well, there's going to be market share. And so there will always be room for that next something or other. Some of it's location driven. Some of it now with the COVID and the lockdown stuff, it's okay. Do you have delivery? Do you have these other pieces that are coming into it? And so that doesn't scare me off quite as much, as long as you can clearly articulate how or why, or both how and why, you are different, or what is different about your business model that does make it unique. So to me, that's what I start to look for. The other vantage point is, if you take kind of the big burger brands like a McDonald's, a Burger King, and a Wendy's, most franchises, especially fixed location franchises, will give you a territory that you have to operate within. Well, if someone buys that territory for the McDonald's in that area, that now that's how you get a Burger King and a McDonald's to ride the coattails of a Burger King and a Wendy's to ride the coattails of McDonald's, because guess what? There's no more room. No one can sell another one. But they can open a competitor across the street,
yeah,
or right down the road, because they figured out that it's kind of working here. And then you have, you know, you have what some I remember reading an article years ago called the Starbucks effect, where there was this big fear of Starbucks going into these communities and killing off local coffee and tea shops and say, oh, my gosh, Starbucks is going to kill it off. What it actually did was it created more awareness of that small local shop that was across the store. Now, did some of them close? Probably. But the basis of the article was actually that it helped more of these local shops because people were going to the Starbucks saying, you know, I think I do like this coffee stuff, or I want to try what else is out. Are there others nearby?
Yeah.
And so they'd find these home local ones.
Yeah, it was the same thing when I, again, 25 years ago, I moved here. I had to commute from Johns Creek, which was, I think it was almost a 40-mile commute to my office in Atlanta. And the first coffee shop I got to was right outside my office. And, you know, now they're
everywhere.
Yeah, they're everywhere. And so obviously it has created more demand. So they've actually increased their market share. What's interesting to me now is in this wave thing that I keep noticing, and I'm in commercial real estate. Now it's counseling franchises, mental health franchises.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's just the new wave or if that's kind of a response to how hard it is to get entry level labor. You know, I'd be kind of curious how you're pivoting a little bit with the inability to find people to serve a burger these days, or, you know.
Well, in the fast food industry, robotics is really taking a huge leap. And so I have a longtime client who's a very well-known, seasoned executive and founder of hundreds of restaurant concepts over the years. And he's seen the trends. And I spoke with him, had talked of how the robotics is coming to take over and replace a lot of these jobs. People don't want to work it. And as minimum wage rates continue to increase to such a capacity where someone's going to say, well, I have unreliable labor. I'm forced with these minimum wage laws. I'm forced to pay in some of the cities now $15, $18 an hour for low skill, low dependability employees. I'm better off. The return on investment starts to come much more quickly for this machinery to take that position.
We hit a drive-thru today. We had a showing. It was one of the worst experiences. And finally, I just went, thank you. You know, I turned to my partner and I'm like, I can't wait for the robots. We just got to have the robots.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you got off one I want to get back to, and that's the market, because your line of questioning said, if I have the most unique idea in the world, which is to be a veterinarian dentist.
You're kind of fixated on that, aren't
you? I am, because I think I have a great idea. I'm onto something. But that's a unique niche, right? But I think a lot of people, if you have a business, you're like, well, it's just, you know, next best thing. I'm going to create a rocket launching system that's going to take people to space, because there's only two people out there doing it. But what I have found is, the reason that you're in business and what makes you unique is being able to deliver and be more dependable and do things. And sometimes you need to make a market. And I've watched two examples here in Atlanta specifically, where if you have this idea, and here's the idea. So my friend just recently sold his business called Granite Garage Floors. And when he first started, it was a DIY event, or your painter would do it. And he said, I'm going to go after this with Granite Garage Floors concept idea. And other people have come into the market. And of course, I'm like, hey, man, what's going on? He goes, I hate those guys. I hate those guys. I said, but at the end of the day, it's building your market. They're advertising. They're putting it on other stuff. That's telling people, oh, I didn't realize I could have an epoxy floor in my garage. And it's actually, he still argues with me, but I said, I still think it helped make his market and helped him franchise his concept. And then eventually he sold it and gone on. I have one other one that happened here locally. We have a company called Shelf Genie, which is also a franchise unit. So the owner of that, or a board member of that, took off and he started the art of the shelf, or I forget the name of it exactly. But I asked the person who was running it for him, I'm like, well, when you're doing that, I said, you're really competing with your same company. He said, no, I'm just trying to help make a market. Right now I have to do all the advertising and let people know you can have adjustable drawers that come out, pull out shelves, and you can do more with your stuff. Now I have somebody else doing it with me. And now we have three different concepts here in Atlanta that are marketing all over the place for Shelf Genie ideas, but that's not the way they think of it. You know, it's just this. So I think it's a good thing if you're in a market, you see somebody else already doing it. They got first mover, and now you get to do the first mover advantage, which is go on top of them, build out their marketing, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, the first mover advantage is a tremendous opportunity. There will always be copycats. It doesn't matter whether you're a franchise or not. The copycats are going to come. If people, it's like, it's maybe a bad analogy, but when there's blood in the water, one shark's going to smell it, the next one's going to come too. Like, they're going to keep coming when they see business opportunity. Same thing, there are knockoffs every day. And whether we like it or not, if you're the leader in your market, whatever that is, if you're that front runner, there are always going to be people clipping at your heels trying to copycat or do this or do that. And that's just the reality of when you take a front runner position, you're going to have that.
Talk to me about axe throwing franchises.
Yeah, I mean, that's the trend has slowed a little bit in terms of companies doing it. But
who thought this was a great idea? Let's drink and throw axes. Sounds like fun. Yeah, Chris. Yeah. I'm thinking from the insurance
my hand going, yes,
liability, all of that. Yeah. I can't even believe that could actually have made it to market.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're expanding. They're expanding everywhere. We always tend to see these trends that come 2 or 3, 4 years before it's kind of a nationally known thing. Well, all these independents that are starting to spring up, they're getting some traction and say, wow, no one's doing this nationally. There are some mom and pops coming up, but we think there's an opportunity to be the first one to, make a regional or a national presence with this. Yeah. Yep.
So you think it started in axe throwing?
No, it just makes it. I just, every time I see that, I'm like, I can't, every once in a while there's an idea out there and you're like, somebody had to come pitch this in the boardroom and they really had to have some serious balls to actually pitch. And I'm like, how did axe throwing actually make, as much fun as it sounds like, my bachelor party was going out and drinking beer and shooting guns. So I get the concept, but I don't think that's franchisable. And so when you think about a sharp axe and beer, I just can't even believe that made it.
Yep.
Somehow in our litigious society.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But it did.
It did.
And it's taken off. I've even done it.
Have you really?
Were
you any good?
I was not.
Did you paint your face like Braveheart?
I definitely, but every throw had a reaction.
You screamed and freedom and then
every time.
Did you moon it?
I had all my family around. I'm going against my daughter. I'm taking you down. I throw it, thing bounces off, and then she gets up there, whips it with one arm, boom, bullseye. I'm like, great, this is fun. But I'm not having fun anymore. I'm going to go back and drink. I'll be back in a minute. And then I got better. No, I'm kidding.
So do people come to you, or do you actually go and you see a business and you're like, I want to talk to that guy or girl about maybe taking their business to the big time?
Yeah, most folks are reaching out to us where we're connecting with them maybe at an expo, or they're finding us online. Most of our business today comes through referrals, just people who we've done business with, connections, no different than probably most companies out there, right? Especially a small business audience is listening in. It's referral. And by the way, referrals account in the franchising business, referrals account for 40% of all franchise sales, 40%. So you talk about brokers and marketing and this and that. It all still comes down to social capital, referrals. So referrals usually are what help, especially long established businesses such as the Trusted Toolbox that has, I'm certain, a large chunk, if not the majority of the business is coming through referrals and repeat customers. When you build a quality business, the same thing happens in franchising as well. So it's that repeat business. And that's where most of our business comes from, maybe a consultant, an attorney, a CPA. They've got a client that they think, wow, my client's got a great business. And they're kind of on the inside and they're usually risk averse. So if they're suggesting to their client that they may want to consider franchising, that's not their natural inclination. So they'll get us connected and we'll see if there's a fit or not.
So is it, all right, let me back this up. Referrals,
there's something in the water today.
There is. Definitely. It's called beer. Yeast, hops. So referrals, going back to this again, you're right. It's referral-based business. And I thought it would be more mechanical. And the more, as soon as you said that, I'm like, well, why would his business be any different than anybody else's business? Because 40% of our business today does come from repeat customers. The next 20 come from satisfied customers who have referred us to their friends. And then the next 20 is from contractor referrals. Other people who say, hey, call these guys. They're better at the small stuff than we are. So you're right. 80% of my business is all from referrals. And all I do is advertise for the next 20%.
Yeah.
So in the referral business, you get that. Is it the referral from the gate opener or the gatekeeper, or is it the owner who says, man, I really want to franchise my idea?
Most of the time, it's the owner. In almost every case, it's the owner that says, I've got to do something with my business. Sometimes they're literally thinking, boy, am I going to sell this thing? Am I going to franchise this? Am I going to grow? And it's literally these two total opposites, sell the business or make a national brand. Like, whoa. But that's oftentimes where they come to us, where they say, I've built this business. It's going great. I've made a nice living. I put my kids through college. Now I'm like, what's next? What am I going to do with this thing? And so it now they're thinking, okay, well, I've got 10 more years that I really want to invest into this. And now what do I do? And either you sell the business, you just stick with what you're doing and maybe try to replace yourself and go figure out something else to do with your time. Or you look at franchising or start expanding to keep you occupied. Most founders, my experience has been, they don't like sitting idle for very long. They think they do, but they don't sit idle for very long.
We've had an exit strategy coach come on the call before in the podcast. And Beth did a great job of explaining that, is that a lot of us who run our own business, number one, we're afraid of we don't know what to do next. So mm-hmm. I don't want to quote unquote sell. And I also don't want to think about leaving it. Mm-hmm. Because I don't have anything else to do. Number two, I haven't put the thought process together. And if I say, hey, it's 10 years out, it's so far out that I really don't have to take action today. And if you don't start taking action today, but as a guy who's actually thought through the exit strategy, which I have, it seems like two totally different mindsets. I actually have already gone out and had my business valued. Mm-hmm. I actually thought about selling it right before COVID. And when COVID hit, I said, well, I'm not going to sell it at a discount. And what happened is my business just boomed.
Yeah.
Even further, and then we continue to grow. But it seems like a totally different mindset. So how do you coach somebody through the I want to sell it versus the I want to franchise it?
So we do very little in terms of coaching them to sell it or not. We'll let them determine that. But one of the first steps of our franchise process we go through, it's called the franchise blueprint. We trademarked that service. And it's really the best way to think of it is a feasibility study. Should we franchises. If we do franchise it, what would this thing look like? Because generally speaking, if you have a profitable business, chances are the business can be franchised. It's just whether or not the owner wants to do it. Is it the right fit? Does it fit with the owner's skill set or what they want to do? And so then it starts looking at, okay, if we do this, what would our franchise fee look like and why? And our royalty fees and our advertising fees and how would we structure our territory? What does it look like if we sell 30, 40, 50 franchises over the next 4, 5, 6 years? What does that look like? What kind of business are we in? Do we really want to do it? How much time is involved? You know, how does that work out? And so really kind of helps assess and provide that owner a lot more detail and specific to decide from, to make it really make a decision from a much more informed perspective if they want to do it or not. And for me, that in one of the reasons we actually created that service was because it was kind of an all or nothing. I've been in franchising, helping companies to do this, like I said earlier, for almost 2 decades now. I can't believe I can say that. But it's kind of either you do everything and you spend a boatload of money and time into franchising, or you just walk away with nothing. It's like, well, is there a middle ground? You know, can we have like a little stepping stone, like a dip my toe in the water? And so that's what we developed with this franchise blueprint process, was to help someone make that evaluation and determine. And what I found, what's interesting is, you know, about half the clients decide not to, you know, they decide that they don't want to franchise.
If somebody's looking at franchising as really an exit strategy, you're going to want that owner to be engaged for how long, you know, until they really, truly can. And obviously the answer is I guess if the franchise takes off or not, and then it's saleable. But
yeah,
realistically, if somebody comes to you and says, hey, you know, I'm thinking about franchising. I really want it to be aiming towards an exit strategy. I mean, what's their time frame? What are you telling them?
Well, I think where we are, there are two different exits we're talking about. First exit is from your core business. So one of the things we were talking about is that owner wanting to get out of their current business, right? So in your example, Chris, maybe you're saying, you know, I love my business, but I don't know if I want to operate my business anymore. I don't want to run that day to day, right?
You're halfway there.
Yeah. So
you got to figure out which half, everybody.
I am
which
so half? Enjoying the look on your face as he's answering this question.
Yeah. So the first exit in franchising is it's a slow transition into becoming a franchisor. So around five units is when you feel the pinch where you really need, you start thinking, boy, I better have a full-time franchise person. Eight units is the breaking point. So once you hit somewhere between five to eight, someone needs to be full-time in the franchise company. So at that juncture, that's when if as the founder or the owner of your business, you want to be full-time into franchising, well, somewhere between five and eight franchises is when that's going to happen. But now you're in a new business. You're in the franchising business. You're still tied in with your current company. And usually you backfill yourself with you promote someone from your company and you backfill, and it's kind of this transition. You identify some duties. And then the second exit you're talking about is really selling that franchise company. Franchise companies are usually far more valuable than the individual operating. Most small businesses, my rule of thumb is it's usually 1.5 to 3 times the earnings to the owner operator, less the depreciated value of it, or plus the depreciated value of it, any assets the company has. In franchising, it's usually we see an 8 to 12 times EBITDA on the net income of a franchise company. So if, you know, very quickly, you can see how those numbers add up. If you have a $200,000 net, you know, that's a $2 million valuation. It's usually significantly higher than what a small business would. And it's because of the royalty stream and income that comes through these long-term contracts. Franchising's really changed a lot in the last 5 years. Private equity is gobbling up every quote deal in franchising there is to be had. Most of them have been gobbled up by private equity.
So when you say gobbled up, talk a little bit about that, because when somebody comes to you, and we'll get to what you do and how you can provide value to people, you're saying that the franchise is running. It's a 5-unit, 8-unit franchise.
Yes.
And the private equities are gobbling them up, or they're gobbling up the guy who may be thinking about franchising.
No. So what happened is when I first got into the franchising business, if you didn't have 100 units, private equity wouldn't even look at you. They weren't interested. Then that number dropped down to about 50. And that was kind of a pretty steady number for many years. And 5 years, 6 years ago, really saw a big transition where it started dropping to 25 units. Then now it's down to, if you have 10 to 20 units operating in your franchise system, private equity is interested because they're understanding the opportunity now to say, well, they might not buy you out completely, but they'll buy 30, 40%. Give you kind of take some chips off the table, right? You take cash out a little bit. Now they infuse some cash to grow it. You may get replaced. They might put a president in or a franchise development person in to help grow it and then make that go. And maybe do a second purchase later on as you expand.
I think if you're thinking about this, you're listening to the podcast and you got a business and maybe you are a franchise. You know, I think a lot of folks that listen that I've heard are really individual owner operators in the small business world already, or thinking about getting into this and taking that wild leap into the safari. But as they go through this, everybody thinks it's going to be that panacea where somebody's going to walk in, they're going to give you a whole big Brinks truck full of money, and you get to stare and look at what $1 million looks like, and then you get to take off and go to the Caribbean.
That's not what happens.
That's not what happens. I'm watching my buddy go through it. I just talked to him about it. I said, man, dude, you're scaring me to stay in my business. I said, you're not helping me, bro. You're not helping me. He goes, man, it's been a lot of work. They've asked him to stay on. No employment contract, but the understanding was earn out for three. He's not an earn out, but he's already been paid. But they asked him to invest back in the company. And then he has to spend all this time with all these people educating them around his business. And he said, I'm busier now than when I was running my own business. I'm like, I don't know about that. Now it's starting to make me think that that's still hard work. Damn it. I can't get away from the hard work. So talk about that for a minute. As you think about going through this process, number one, it's hard to franchise the business with the steps. And so you help people with that. I get that part. And then that next thing is if you're using that as your exit strategy or where you want to go with something, it's even harder to go and then sell off to private equity and do all that. Have you been involved with people in those transactions as well?
Yeah. And I know when private equity groups are contacting me, that the threshold of interest, because most of our clients have somewhere between 0 and 10 franchises. That's the majority of the client base, because we're working with these emerging brand, 0 franchise, helping them launch and then kind of go to market. That's what we do. That's our expertise. And so when 2 weeks ago, I have a $4.5 billion private equity group reach out to me with, say, we're looking for franchising. I literally told the people on the other line, I said, well, you guys missed the boat. You know, that you're 3 years too late. I mean, so I said, the new trend, by the way, if you want to try to get ahead of it, the new trend in franchising is they're buying large multi-unit operators or investing in them. So for example, the largest Pizza Hut franchisee, multi-unit, had 500 something units. They just invested in him and purchased the second largest. So now it's all one group that owns 1,000 Pizza Hut franchises. So that to me, and I'm just, you know, this is my prediction, I guess, or is I see this happening, the same kind of thing. They're going to buy up these large multi-units and aggregate them, and then they'll just keep trickling down from 500 to 300 to 200 to 150 unit franchisees. And, you know, we'll see, I think, the same kind of thing happen going on, because they're starting to recognize, wow, these multi-units, even though they're paying royalty, they have a whole massive business enterprise here.
Wow.
So as Chris said, a lot of the folks listening are people who just started a business or they're thinking about starting a business. And I know Chris's story really well. I mean, he spent a lot of time on his business plan before he even left his job. So if you're actually that thoughtful and you're going, you know what, I'm going to build a business that I intend to take to franchise, do you have some advice for somebody who's hasn't even started yet on different things that they should incorporate in their business plan that they might not otherwise?
Yeah. So the first thing I tell anyone that's starting a business and is thinking, well, maybe I might franchise in the future. Whether you do or you don't, if you're thinking franchising, what I like about that is you're thinking replication. So when you think about the fact that you're going to have to train and teach someone how to do it. So simple is better. And it's no different than training employees. So that will produce a return for you just in training your own staff. The second thing is really make sure that you have a profitable model. I really don't care what you're offering. If you're not running a business that's profitable, you're going to have a hard time selling that or convincing someone that it is. So having that profitable prototype is important. There are certainly exceptions to every rule, but the general rule of thumb here, which is why most clients we work with have been operating for 3 years, because they've had some time, 3 years at a minimum or more, where they've had some time to operate, figure things out, figure out some profitability, understand the ups and downs with the clients as they're going through it.
I'm not as smart as those guys, because if you had asked me in year three if I could have done it, I would have said, yeah. And looking back on it now, I'm like, hell no. Number one, you're not profitable, bro, because it was coming in the recession.
Yeah,
I was still figuring things out as well. So I think as people are hearing this, it's not a 3 year and go, unless you listen to what Tom's advice is and start to build those processes and make sure that you're watching your numbers, which we all have to watch our numbers.
Yeah. And that was the last point I was going to make, is the financials. You have to watch your numbers. That's such a common mistake. And having met with business brokers, that's their number one complaint. And their number one, whether you franchise, whether you sell the business, the consistent information I get from other experts is have those numbers. No, I don't care if you know your numbers, but I do care that your numbers are accurate. You don't have to know them, but your QuickBooks or your accounting, whatever you're using, is accurate, and that your business is not a personal slush fund. So let's make sure you keep that clean.
It's not a slush fund. It's a travel fund.
Oops.
Oh, damn it. Speaking of which, I just started booking all kinds
of travel. So much for franchising for Chris.
Oh, yeah. Boy. It's a travel fund, not a slush fund.
Yeah. Now, look, owner benefits, one thing, right? You go to conferences, you fly around, you extend your trips. Like, that's owner benefit. That's a value add.
I've had some great conferences.
You're really good at
Spain, owner benefit. Cancun.
Yeah.
Daytona. It was an opportunity. All right, we're coming to the end of our episode, and I didn't have a chance to bring this up. If I'm thinking about taking my idea for a franchise, how long should I expect to have to work with somebody like you who's going to take me through the franchise blueprint, help me set it up, and then actually start to work on the multiple units? How long should I expect to take on that?
Yeah, most brands, it's a 3 to 6 month process. Yeah. Now, if for an owner that's involved.
That's
now,
quick.
Yeah.
I thought so too. As soon as you said 3 to 6 months, I actually, in my head, I was thinking it was going to take a year or two.
Yeah, me too.
Now, to be fair, there are plenty of clients that do take a year or two, and it's just because they dink and dunk a little bit to mix it in with their current business activity. So sure. If you can pull away and dedicate an hour or two a week, you can be done comfortably in six
months.
That's
probably a good test for you. If somebody can get through the process in 3 to 6 months, then you know you probably have a viable candidate. Because one of the challenges I see in franchising is sometimes the strength of the business is really the personality of the owner, and that you can't replicate.
No, you're right. And we really are, our service and going through our process is a training ground. It's really starting to get someone behaving like a franchisor. If they can't pull away to fill out a questionnaire or to review a document for an hour or two here and there, it's not constant. Even if they're not ready at the time, it forces them now to start saying, oh, wait, I can't do this. I have to put someone else in place to do that, or I need to change how I'm doing things a little bit. And so that in the exercise of doing it helps them become prepared for franchising.
All right, next part is this. So 3 to 6 months, or maybe take a year. How much time away from my business do I need to be able to dedicate to work with you to get my idea franchised?
I budget 1 to 2 hours a week.
That's it. 1 to 2 hours a week. That's it.
On average. Yeah. Now, keep in mind, some weeks you're going to have a few weeks.
You could do that from your boat.
Well, it cuts into my golf time.
Yeah.
I mean, now it's only like, I can only play like 9 to 12 holes. I can't play all 18. Damn. That's a non-starter guy. Sorry. Yeah. Well, I'm kidding. All right. So 1 to 2 hours a week, a lot less than I thought. And I think a lot of people probably, if you're listening to this in the truck and you're driving around, you're probably, whoa, that doesn't sound as bad as I thought.
Yeah,
because that's not gonna take your focus away from your business, because that's the hard part. When you go thinking about, okay, I'm gonna go sell my business, are you all in and invested in your business still, or are you letting things slip because you're thinking about that panacea where the truck backs up and drops the million? What I have seen is that the minute somebody starts thinking about, I'm truly gonna get rid of the business, or I'm gonna sell my business, they don't take care of the business that we built.
Yeah, that's right. And I've seen so many times that owners, the founders, when they franchise, they forget that franchising, you are starting a new business, and you are back to kind of that startup mode for another 2 to 3 years. And so sometimes clients go through it. They think they are mentally prepared for that. But when it comes down to it, as a business owner, myself included, for my own company, it's easy to get comfortable in the lifestyle you've created for yourself, because it's exactly what you want. It's like, like Chris was mentioning, I like taking my trips and conferences and going here and there and doing that. I like what I do. And so now you're stepping into, you're crossing that threshold to this new business expansion model that requires a little more TLC, and you can't outsource that. The owner needs to be involved.
All right. Now the big question. How much money should somebody have squirreled away before they do this? How much capital? Because I talk about this a lot. When I wrote that in my book. Go ahead, Alan.
Oh, you have a book?
Thank you. This book. I'm glad you brought that up. This episode is sponsored by From the Zoo to the Wild, your guide to entrepreneurial freedom and wealth. You can find it on Amazon, written by Chris LaLamia. You're going to love it. Still getting royalty payments, by the way.
That's nice.
I actually just got some good feedback on it. Back to that point, as I said, when I started my business, you got to have the financial and mental wherewithal to start a business. And you hit it right on that. This is starting another business. How much money should we have ready to go to invest in this?
Yeah. The general rule of thumb, when a client asks or a prospective client asset, I tell the client to budget around $100,000. And that's going to be spent over the course of the first, most likely 18 to 36 months. So think of that in terms of, it's not all upfront, it's not all over the first year. It's really closer to 2 to 3 year time period. And so a lot of clients are able to cash flow. Most of them do. They're able to just kind of work it out of cash flow as they go along. But you need to come in with that mindset. And the way we work, about half that's going to be spent on hiring consultants like us and franchise lawyers and working with crews. And then the other half is going to be spent on marketing for lead generation. And the average in today's world, the most recent report out, it on average, it costs about $9,000 in marketing spend to sell one franchise. So if you were to average that out and say, okay, well, easy math means that at around $50,000 budget over that 2 to 3 year time window, that should generate 5 franchise sales for you. It, you know, based on the averages, if we're a little short, maybe it's 2 or 3, maybe we get lucky and we're at 7 to 10, but that's enough to supercharge. Cause the way franchising works, what makes it so beautiful is that upfront franchise fee can then be reinvested. On average, that's $35,000. You get paid by someone to train them, teach them, and you can take even that then refills your coffers. And so now you can take that and spend that next $9,000 to $10,000 on marketing right out of that next franchise fee. And so that becomes the operating cash flow of your business to keep it going for that franchise model. And so that's really kind of what I like to look at for that secret or magic number that I like to budget. If you're budgeting that over the first 2 or 3 years, don't think of it all upfront cash. I mean, you can get a loan and do that, but most end up just cash flowing it.
Yep. Yeah, well said. I think that's a good point. We're coming to the end, Alan. Is there any other big question you've got to ask?
No, I got a million, but that's okay.
All right.
That's okay.
You sure?
Yeah.
All right.
We'll have to have him back.
We're going to have him back. This has been fun. I know, and obviously he brings the heat, brings that energy, man. He's full of it. He's ready to rock and roll, but I've got to ask him 3 questions because I have gotten some incredible feedback that these 3 questions with one guy. He actually fast forwards to the end, listens to that, then goes back. And sometimes, depending on how good we're doing, he will listen to it or he won't. But he always has to listen to these last 3 questions.
That's great.
Because we've had some fascinating ones over the years year.
No pressure.
Yeah. Okay.
I think this one will be good. All right. First question we got for you. What is your favorite feature of your house?
Yes. So I came prepared. Thank you well for done. Giving these in advance so I could think about that. For me, my favorite room. I have two in my home. The first is our screen porch. Love sitting out on that early mornings or late evening or early evenings when the sun's rising or setting. It's great. And the second is it's probably designed to be a study, but we turned it into a music room for our family. So we're a musical family. Our kids play piano. My wife and I are musicians. And
what do you play?
Guitar, piano. My primary instrument, I would say, is voice. I've always been a vocalist and a singer.
Oh, wow. Look at this.
Sing our theme song.
Yeah, no,
we got to write one.
That's right. We just need a jingle.
Yeah.
Wait, 800, call me.
We had somebody play a saxophone on the podcast.
Trumpet. We had somebody play a trumpet. And I said, that's right. We're definitely going to have Tom back.
Yeah.
And then we can play our recorder and our triangle. Ding.
Cowbell.
More cowbell. I just need more cowbell. That's awesome. That's great because when you talk about families in houses, that's some of the consistent things you'll hear about is enjoyment. When people never, I've yet to hear my favorite feature of the house is the front door that I spent $10,000 on. Nope, nobody ever says that. It's always where the family gathers or where they enjoy themselves or, you know, especially as we get ready to go into American football season in the fall, people love doing that. So,
yep.
All right, let's switch gears and talk about what is a customer service pet peeve?
Yeah. So for me, the one when I was thinking about it that I always cringe every time is just that the customer service person, whether it's a server, someone in a retail setting, or even someone on a phone call, it's the lack of just a smile or courtesy, right? Something simple, right? But I don't want to call it disgust, but the lack of interest, like as if the customer is interrupting that person for whatever they're doing, right?
So he just I didn't know it was coming, but I will tell you, the person who was talking to me about this said, I am so interested that the common theme has been lack of interest or engagement from employees or the person providing the service. And you hit on it yet again.
Yeah.
So tell me what you're going to do with your robot now, big boy. Huh? Yeah, I guess we got to put some eyes on it.
Yeah, it's going to have a sexy voice too.
Yeah.
I don't care. I mean, you should have been with me. It was a Burger King drive-thru today. And I mean, I expected them to throw the food at me. And actually, when I got to the window, the person that handed me the food was great. So what drives me crazy is, for some reason, so many business owners take their worst employee, probably because they can't do anything else, and then they put them to be the face of the company and the first point of contact with the customer. It drives me insane.
That's why I call my ladies who answer the phones my first touch customer superstars, right? Because they're the ones who are setting the tone for the interaction with our first touch customer service superstar.
Trying to see if that actually spelled something, but it doesn't.
Thank God it doesn't.
Yeah.
I didn't think about it that way. Oh, lawsuit coming. Yeah. Oh, shit. I got to find the HR department.
That's me. With an F.
Anyway, right, because it that sets the tone, but the lack of the indifference. And there's a lot of times where I go, you know what? I'm not blaming you. It's not your fault. It is your company. It is the process. It's the culture that they didn't build.
But some
build
people suck. Surely they shouldn't have been hired. They shouldn't have been put there. They should have been trained. But at some point, pull your head out of your butt and just show some common courtesy. Do a little golden rule. I mean, come on. Give me something. And
so then it's the same
in a restaurant. They expect a tip.
Yeah. And that was all you were tipping.
Yeah.
You know, when we went to Spain, we are, here in the US, we're known as being huge over tippers.
Yeah.
And in Spain, they don't expect a tip at all. And my wife, who actually worked at a Pizza Hut growing up, always insists on having more than 20% given. And she did that once. I'm like, my son's like, no, mom, because he had been over there for a couple of months before we got there. He goes, mom, you can't do that. She goes, oh, no, we're doing that. And sure enough, we did it.
It's really hard to not tip.
It is. It's really hard to not tip when it's ingrained in your culture. Literally, we're walking out and the lady's trying to come back and give us the money. and so it was great. All right. Lastly, and most fun for me, give us a DIY construction remodeling nightmare story.
All right. So I had two, but I'm going to go with the one that really resonated most for this. So it was my first home. And so we did a lot of do-it-yourselfer kind of stuff. And we had in our home, some of the blinds that this stopped working, right? The crank to turn it stopped working. And so my wife and I were like, oh man, what are we going to do? So we find, I'm like, well, let's just, I guess, repair the blinds. I don't know. I heard blinds are expensive. You know, go figure. We could have looked it up. We're like, I heard blinds are expensive. So let's go get it repaired. So we take it to a repair shop. And
I'm laughing already.
And the repair shop takes it. He says, okay, we can repair this. You know, we've got to send it out to get the part from China because it's old. We got to get the part and it's going to take some time. I said, okay. And it's like a $20 repair. So I said, great, 20 bucks. Cool. Works out fine. So leave the blinds. 4 weeks go by, call, check in with guy. Hey, any update? No, we haven't got the part yet. Oh, okay. Another 4 weeks go by. Hey, what's going on? No, nothing. It was like 4 months. Okay. That the blinds, which this is in our living room. So it's just wide open, right? You know, night and day, it doesn't matter. Wide open in the living room. So I finally start pestering the guy and I said, well, I'm pretty patient, but it's been 4 months. Like, do I need to take it somewhere else? Like, whatever, just tell me. And so after some pestering he eventually finally said, well, look, like, I don't understand why you're getting these cheap blinds fixed. You know, these are just cheap blinds from Home Depot. You can go get them cut. They cost 10 bucks or 20 bucks or something. And I said, well, I wish you had told me that, you know, 4 months ago. I have no idea. I was, you know, way over my head.
First home buyer. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
We all have done that. And that's a great lesson for everybody. If you've never owned a home and you're sitting in your home, you're going to go do something like that because we all have.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm going to go get JB Weld. I'm going to weld this sucker up and no problemo. This door is going to work again. And the door handle, of course, comes flying right back off. And you're like, you just spent 16 bucks on JB Weld and you could have just spent 25 bucks and got a brand new door handle.
So much for JB Weld as a sponsor, Chris.
Well, now, to be fair,
I almost made him speechless.
Yeah, you did. To be fair, I have used JB Weld in a lot of pinches and it saved my butt, especially with some of it. But we've done that. If you think about it too, you spent what, 4 or 5 hours total by the time you're done?
And
you're,
easy, you're like, easily.
You could have just gone to a depot, Lowe's, got a cut, gone back in, slapped that sucker in, you would have been done in an hour tops from leaving the house to coming back.
Yeah, it would have been a no-brainer. And I had no clue. I didn't know. I had no clue. I was like, well, I don't know. It's a blind. I don't know. I heard they're expensive. That's all I know. Yeah. So
I love it. That's it. Actually, we've heard some doozies when it comes to DIY nightmare stores, usually with not a whole lot of fire yet, but yeah, a lot of water.
Yeah, a lot of flooding, a little bit of fire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But all right, Tom, we've really enjoyed this Big Sky franchise team. How can people find you? Tell us a little bit more about how we can get a hold of you and pitch yourself for a little bit.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the time. And the best way to reach out is just through our website, bigskyfranchiseteam.com. We offer free consultation. We've got a ton of free resources. We have a free franchisability quiz. We have a free download called 9 Pitfalls to Avoid When Franchising Your Business. We offer a free consultation. There's no cost for anything until you say, let's do business. So we make it really easy just to have an initial conversation, talk about things. We have a podcast, which you've been a guest on, called Multiply Your Success.
Great podcast.
Yep. Thank
great
you.
Episode.
Yeah. No, but I've it actually is a great episode.
I do listen to his podcast too, because he has three questions he asks everybody, which are also really interesting. Why don't you just share those three questions that you ask everybody? Because I think it's mind expanding for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I love the show format. You know, it's great with what you do. And our three questions are, have you had a miss in your business or career and something you learned from it? Talk about a make on the other side, and then multiplier. How have you multiplied yourself, your business, with whatever you're doing?
Rock and roll. I love that stuff. He asked me to miss, and I said, do we have another hour? He goes, well, Chris, we've got to keep it in the time. I'm like, oh, okay. All right. Awesome, Tom. Thanks again for being here. Let's make it all go happen, right? Small Business Safari, go out there. Make sure you're hitting us up, checking us out. We're out there. Go rate, review, follow us. Tell your friends about us. I'm finding out that all my friends who are listening aren't really podcast listeners. I got to find more podcast listeners. So people listen to them all the time. These guys are one-offs. Go out there and find some people. Get them out here. Get them listening to us. And we're going to get you up that mountaintop of success.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Small Business Safari. Remember to keep that positive attitude, which will reflect in a higher altitude as you're out there making it happen in the wild world of small business ownership. Until next time, go make it a great day, adventure team.